This is a special takeaway hour on the EPA for Friday, May 26th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening.
Each of us all across this great land has a stake in maintaining and improving environmental quality.
We're going back to 1972 here. That's President Richard Nixon speaking in a way that you don't hear today from most Republicans. Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970 because of events like the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland catching fire in 1969.
The Cuyahoga River is an exhausted stream, abused and misused by man and his machine.
There was a national awareness for the first time that if humans could damage the environment so dramatically, that damage could be irreversible.
Clean air and clean water, the wise use of our land, the protection of wildlife and natural beauty, parks for all to enjoy. These are part of the birthright of every American.
The mission of the EPA started out as a bipartisan one and stayed that way for years. Nearly half a century later, it's now turned into one of the most politicized government agencies, at least to outsiders, with a deregulator at its helm, proposed budget cuts of 30%, and an unknown future. So today, we're dedicating an hour-long special to the EPA, whose actions could have such an impact on how millions of Americans live for years to come. We'll look at the history of the agency, how politics have shaped it since 1970, and what could change under the Trump administration and the EPA's new administrator, Scott Pruitt.
The early need for the EPA was really focused on clean air, clean water, a response to industry pollution.
That's Emily Holden, a climate and environment reporter for E&E News. She spends her days covering the EPA, and she says it took about a decade for the bipartisan spirit that founded the agency in 1970 to begin to fade. In 1981, new President Ronald Reagan was elected to shrink government, and he installed an EPA administrator with a familiar name.
Ann Gorsuch, the mother of Neil Gorsuch, Supreme Court Justice, who was appointed to run the EPA by President Reagan. And her view of the EPA was really that it was overstepping the bounds of its authority. She wanted to shrink its size. And under her, it saw about near a quarter cut in its budget. During the George H.W. Bush administration, we saw the introduction of the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments that were looking at things like ozone depletion. Acid rain was a problem. There was a cap-and-trade program implemented to deal with that. Then in 1997, when we really started talking about climate change at this broad level and involving EPA, was when the global agreement on climate change, the Kyoto Protocol, was finalized. And the Clinton administration at that time did not push on that because the Senate took a vote and essentially said, you know, this isn't something that we want to pursue without India and China pursuing it at an equal level.
So at what point then, though, did the EPA in the public's mind become synonymous with climate change and really the ideology of climate change? Because the EPA now is either loved by a lot of people on the left and environmentalists, reviled by many people on the right as a tool of big government. When did that happen?
I think a lot of it happened under the Obama administration. So a little bit of history here. Back to the Kyoto Protocol, the Bush administration also determined that it could not regulate greenhouse gases. And later on, there was a lawsuit called Massachusetts v. EPA that determined that the EPA does have the responsibility to regulate greenhouse gases that are causing climate change. And so what really politicized things was a vote in Congress in 2010 on cap and trade. There were ads running at the time saying this is going to make your gasoline more expensive, you know, on pumps that people were looking at when they were filling up their cars.
I sued EPA, and I'll take dead aim at the cap and trade bill.
The House took up a bill to limit carbon emissions with this market system and passed it and sent it to the Senate, and then the Senate never took it up. And you have to keep in mind, too, that just 2 years earlier, the 2008, the nominee, John McCain, he had within his platform several lines about how climate change was a big risk and something that needed to be addressed. And so this swung back the other way very quickly.
So then the question becomes, I mean, could you have had a Scott Pruitt without the controversies of the Obama years that you're talking about?
So I wrote a story when Scott Pruitt was picked to be EPA administrator about how he sort of rode this wave of federalism to power. If you look back at his history, almost all of the cases that he brought were against the federal government for overreach. And one of the things that he sued on was the Obama administration's really key climate policy, which was called the Clean Power Plan, which would have enacted standards to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. He thinks that states should be doing most of this regulating.
Realistically, what are the areas that Scott Pruitt could most affect during his term here in the Trump administration at the EPA?
One of the key areas that we talk about is the Clean Power Plan, but we also have to look at the general trend in the electric sector that is decarbonizing. And so without the Clean Power Plan, we won't get there as quickly, but we are still moving in the same direction. I think I would probably focus on the things that the administration can do that are not necessarily just at EPA, but are to kind of further the development of oil and gas and also coal production. And they can do a lot more for oil and gas than they can do for the coal industry.
For people on the outside, then, Emily Holden, do you think that the EPA in 2020 is going to be an agency that they recognize?
I think we'll be looking at a very different agency. It depends in large part how severe the budget cuts will be and how many staff will be leaving. But I do think that Administrator Scott Pruitt has a big opportunity to reshape the way the agency works.
Emily Holden, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Emily Holden is a reporter for E&E News covering energy and environment and the EPA in Washington. Administrator Ann Gorsuch led a 22% cut of the EPA's budget. But some former administrators find solace in how the Gorsuch story ended. It ended with her resignation following a congressional investigation.
The strength of congressional disapproval of the performance of the EPA administrator was intolerable. And the agency righted the ship. The Reagan administration did not again attempt to deregulate in any significant way. The agency, in fact, I think they had come to understand that the public wouldn't accept it.
That's William Riley. He's a Republican who represents some of the bygone era of bipartisan support for environmental issues. Riley served as administrator of the EPA between 1989 and 1993 under President George H.W. Bush.
The problems that we addressed in my time at EPA were largely visible problems of severe pollution, and this was pollution you could see or smell or touch, where climate change is just not something you can touch and feel, and there's been so much ideological science denying. Difficult to say how much the agency is changing in its day-to-day enforcement. What the agency does is police environment from air and water and toxics on a day-to-day basis, largely through permitting. I've not seen any data to show that there's been a fall off in the issuance of permits or the rigor that's applied to them. On the other hand, there's very little leadership at the agency. There's an administrator, a deputy administrator, one or two assistant administrators. And thus far, the indications are that there will be a reconsideration of the kinds of programs that were important and priorities in previous administrations. A very serious reconsideration, an abandonment of most voluntary programs. And I really don't understand the rationale. These are hugely effective programs by any measure you apply. So the reductions that are proposed for EPA, which will cripple some very important and I think essential functions, are entirely unjustifiable.
So you were running the EPA between 1989 and 1993 under George H.W. Bush. Do you remember a moment or a time or a month when climate denial or climate change all of a sudden became a politically toxic issue? Do you remember it?
It was an issue within our administration. Our own chief of staff, vice president, budget director essentially were skeptics of the whole science and of the modeling that it's based upon. The president felt very strongly about climate and was, I think, the first developed country head of state to sign the climate convention, and I know was the first to get it ratified by the Senate. But there was already a division within the government, not really giving a high priority to the environment, not having the kind of leadership that had been there when President Nixon created EPA, for example. and not having learned the statutes. And one of the things I learned was when I testified, I didn't get the help and defense that I ordinarily expected from the Republican ranking figures. I didn't get it because the Republicans didn't know the issues. They hadn't been fully involved and engaged in the Clean Air Act, which is a very complicated statute anyway. The Republican Party, in short, was already drifting away from the environment, from the kinds of people who had led it in the early 70s and on up to the early 80s. There were a few still around. Senator Chafee of Rhode Island is a very notable one. But as the power in the party and the strength of the party shifted from the Northeast and Midwest to the South, Southwest, the complexion of green, shall we say, faded.
Is Scott Pruitt, in your view, a logical progression of the politicized environment of the EPA, or is he an outlier?
There have been times, and the George W. Bush administration was one, when the environment and EPA were not, by any stretch of the imagination, a priority. But even in those times, we had administrators who were committed to the essential core missions of the agency, who were not attempting to dismantle or eliminate some of the most successful programs. And the agency proceeded with a great deal, I thought, of effectiveness and integrity throughout those years under quality leadership. This administration and this EPA administrator are aberrant. We've not seen anything like this before. The administrator has made his name suing the agency he now leads. He has immediately moved to do some things which are consistent with the lawsuits, but highly favorable also to the kind of constituents he served and who contributed to his campaigns as Attorney General of Oklahoma. I think he's made himself clear also that he considers that carbon dioxide is not a contributor to climate change, which is wholly inconsistent with mainstream science. So this is different. What I would hope is that there will be a response, that people in the Congress, who thus far, by the way, have disregarded President Trump's most stringent reduction proposals, that they will consider and conclude enough's enough, that a deregulator cannot effectively run a regulatory agency.
William Riley, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
William Riley was administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency between 1989 and 1993 under President George H.W. Bush. Coming up this hour on The Takeaway, you'll have a view from inside the EPA.
If I were to get a call after ending this interview with you today saying that people didn't take very favorably to my comments and my role at the EPA was being terminated, frankly, I would wear that as a badge of honor.
We also have the man who helped create the dilemma of the EPA today.
I hope that President Trump's administration doesn't just turn into a delay in this long march to climate nirvana that the left is promoting. I think this is our big chance to get out of it and stop this once and for all.
All that and much more on this special hour on the EPA. Stay tuned. Scott Pruitt was picked by the president to head the EPA. That choice alarmed many environmentalists because Pruitt is someone who spent much of his career fighting the agency. The EPA didn't respond to our numerous requests for an interview with Scott Pruitt, but another person who's central to the Trump administration's vision for the EPA is Myron Ebel.
I've always been trying to get the facts out, the actual science, not the claims of the alarmist community, and not the claims of the climate modelers.
Ebel was one of the first major players in mainstream climate denial. Back in the late 90s, Ebel helped produce the Global Climate Science Communications Plan, and the aim was to persuade, quote, a majority of the American public that significant uncertainties exist in climate science.
The climate science is pretty settled, and it's not alarmist. It's that there is a modest rate of warming, mild impacts. And on the policy side, there's huge costs with no benefits for reducing emissions.
After the 2016 election, President Trump chose Ebel to lead his transition team for the EPA. So I asked him about the EPA's agenda under this president.
The goal of the transition was very simple. to implement the president's campaign promises to undo the so-called Clean Power Plan for existing power plants, the emissions rule for new power plants, to withdraw the big wetlands rule, the waters of the U.S. rule, to withdraw from the Paris Climate Treaty, to undo the methane rules, and so on. Those were very specific promises, and they are part of his larger vision to turn the economy around, particularly in what I would call the material economy, the people who are in resource industries and manufacturing and agriculture, people who make stuff, dig up stuff, or grow stuff for a living. That part of the economy has been stagnant now for quite a long time. I think a large part of it is due to the regulatory policies coming out of Washington and particularly coming out of the EPA.
Why do you suspect the president has not pulled out of the climate Paris Agreement as promised? Why hasn't he just done it?
You know, there's a big debate within the administration. There are people who want him to keep his promise, people who want him to break his promise. The people who want him to break his promise, I would describe as essentially coming from the swamp, people like Secretary Rex Tillerson.
Wait, I'm sorry. That was an assessment of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson as part of the swamp that Donald Trump should want to raise. Of course, he's a former CEO of ExxonMobil.
Right. Well, ExxonMobil, of course, since 2007 or 8, has supported a carbon tax. And the day after, or the 2 days after the president was elected, Exxon announced that they still supported a carbon tax and they still supported the Paris Climate Treaty. So they made it clear that they don't agree with the president or with the people who voted for him.
Now, ExxonMobil, of course, also supports you and has supported your work for a lot of your career. A lot of people have attributed that support by the fossil fuel industry for a lot of your scientific positions.
Well, they're wrong. You know, Exxon was public in their support of CEI, but they announced that they were going to stop doing that. Exxon has changed its position, but I and CEI have not.
You know, Martin Ebel, before we let you go, I spoke with William Riley, who was an administrator of the EPA under President George H.W. Bush from 1989 to 1993. He said that the administration that you helped implement at the EPA, including Scott Pruitt, he called them aberrant. He said they're off the scale, not part of a continuum, but aberrant. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that the Trump administration is a chance because of the unusual nature of President Trump and where he came from. What he offers us is to get off of the establishment think of Republican Bush people who are still hanging around, like Bill Riley, Christie Todd Whitman would be another person you could mention, George Shultz. You know, they're honorable people who think that the environmental movement is something very different from what it actually is. And there's something very condescending in their approach, which I think President Trump really has a chance to not only get us out from under from it, but also to get the Republican Party out from under it.
Well, it's fair enough for you to characterize their approach any way you want to, but there's no question that we're in a new era where there used to be some form of political consensus around the type of environmentalism or generally the type of environmental regulation that EPA did. You're saying that the new EPA should be outside of the political consensus that's existed for decades, and that's something remarkable in American politics, don't you think?
Well, I hope it turns out to be remarkable. I hope it doesn't just sink back into the swamp. The problem with the environmental movement is that it's gone way beyond the goals of protecting the environment. We are now in an era where the Environmental Protection Agency is really, someone else said this, it's really the number two economic policy agency in the government after the Treasury Department. And the regulators are out of control. They are spending more and more of their time not doing what is required by Congress, by statute, but freelance regulation of discretionary regulation where they just decide that things ought to be regulated, where Congress hasn't told them that they're required to do so. So I think EPA really is out of control. I think it has very strong support from the environmental movement, which is largely funded by leftist billionaires and very large foundations, which are now controlled by the left. I think they are the extremists. I think they have pulled the agency into places where it shouldn't be, And I'm hoping that Administrator Pruitt, with the support of President Trump, will put the EPA back in its initial intentions when it was created to protect the environment in a way that makes some sense and that isn't based on a radical political agenda.
Myron Ebel is director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he led President Trump's transition team at the EPA. This is the lunchtime crowd at Backslope Brewery in Columbia Falls, Montana. Backslope serves locals and tourists, and down in the basement, owner and city councilman Darren Fisher is doing the never-ending scut work of cleaning his beer kegs.
Get all the liquid out of there, purge it, and then pressurize the keg with CO2, get it up to about 14 PSI, and then seal it off, closed system, ready to put beer in it.
Columbia Falls is a small city with a population of less than 5,000 in Flathead County in northwest Montana. It's tucked right next to Glacier National Park, and that's how it got its nickname, the Gateway to Glacier. The city was once home to Columbia Falls Aluminum Company, CFAC, the locals call it. It was an aluminum reduction plant, and at its peak, it employed 1,500 people in town. Aluminum reduction at the plant ended in 2009, and the plant closed permanently in 2015. Glencore is the company that owns the site now, and it's a site that's been dogged with environmental concerns. There are open waste pits, some of them unlined, on the property. Aluminum reduction involves cyanide and arsenic and dozens of potentially hazardous chemicals, and now the soil around the site and near the surrounding river is contaminated.
Now we're coming into what's called Aluminum City.
I got in the car with Darren, and we took a ride around Columbia Falls.
They are on wells out here and septics. They're not hooked into our water and sewer. So this neighborhood had the biggest concern about cyanide and arsenic leaching into their wells.
Then in September of 2016, after a long public debate, the CFAC property near Aluminum City was officially designated an EPA Superfund site.
You know, we have a kind of a double whammy. Not only are the jobs gone, but now there's a closed Superfund site in the area, and we're praying that it isn't anything near equal to Libby.
That's Montana Republican State Senator Dee Brown, Dee, as she's known to the locals. And the Libby she's referring to is the infamous Superfund site in Libby, Montana.
Vermiculite ore, which was mined and processed there for over 70 years, is contaminated with tremolite.
The team had found in the records was a strong indication of environmental exposure.
Brad, it's so hard to... I'm trying to get oxygen and I can't. It just won't expand anymore.
Asbestos contamination from the vermiculite mine decimated that community in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and was linked to hundreds of deaths. Libby was declared a Superfund site in 1999, and the cleanup continues even today. Dee Brown was key to getting the EPA to come to Columbia Falls and CFAC, though as a conservative Republican sensitive to Montana politics, she doesn't clamor to take credit for it. A Superfund designation means testing and data collection and enforcement from the EPA, but it's not a welcome label for everyone in Columbia Falls, like Flathead County Commissioner Phil Mitchell.
I mean, it's okay that they're here. It's just government bureaucracy. I'm not into it. I think as long as a private party, which is this is a private party, is performing, then I don't think we needed it as a Superfund site.
And there's another reason people are concerned about the Superfund designation, stigma.
Yeah, well, all you got to do is think about where are there Superfund sites. Is it detrimental to Libby, Montana? Oh, yes. There's not a question. Did that have to be a Superfund site? Probably, because it's on such a massively different scale. But there is a stigma about, do I want to live in a town Libby anymore? Because it's a Superfund site. I think there is a stigma, but not at the same level as the aluminum plant.
I'm sorry, but that's just not true.
That's Stacy Schnabel there. She's a local business owner, a former director of the Chamber of Commerce, and a member of Glencore's community liaison panel.
I feel like moving forward, the community will see that. There's not a negative effect. There's not a negative impact. And in fact, it's not a bad thing for your local economy to have those cleanup dollars coming into your economy to be working on cleaning that site up.
And it's important for long-term sustainability, says Aaron Sexton, also a member of the community liaison panel and a senior scientist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station.
In my work, I work with big companies and contaminations from more or so open pit coal mining. What you find is that you need everybody at the table to address these problems. Like I said, these are forever problems for the community, and we need all the horsepower we can get. And in the other areas of my work where I've worked with EPA scientists, they're good people. They're really good scientists. They're trained to deal with these problems. And they're EPA scientists that live here in Montana. They're Montanans, and they care about these communities just as much as we do. People are rightly concerned about the stigma of a Superfund site for the community, but a much bigger stigma would be having an abandoned aluminum plant site and contamination that would leach forever into our watershed. That would be far more harming to our community and our economy than the actual Superfund listing.
So far in this process, Glencore has put up a $4 million bond for assessment at the CFAX site, but they haven't committed to more in what everyone expects will be years of cleanup. We reached out to Glencore, but they didn't get back to us. Meanwhile, locals hope that having the EPA on the scene will mean accountability, but they're worried. The Trump administration's budget proposes a 30% cut to Superfund cleanups, like the one in Columbia Falls.
Now we have the listing and the EPA possibly under threat, and that's concerning to me, that if we're going to be looking at the Antiquities Act and the last monuments that have been designated, are we also going to be looking at the last Superfund sites that have been designated? And what will the community take a loss on that one?
The EPA is in a state of change and uncertainty. We wanted to talk with some of the people who were experiencing that change firsthand. Joe Arvai is a member of the EPA Science Advisory Board.
There are two advisory boards that provide guidance to the Environmental Protection Agency. One is the Chartered Scientific Advisory Board, which is the board that I serve on. That provides advice directly to the Office of the Administrator. The other is called the Board of Scientific Counselors. It's there to advise the Office of Research and Development, which is basically EPA's internal peer review board for their own science.
Since he took office at the EPA, Scott Pruitt has decided to replace half the members on the 18-member Board of Scientific Counselors who were there at the end of their three-year terms. Those terms are typically renewed, but in some cases, Pruitt has instead terminated them. Felicia Chase is a water enforcement researcher in the EPA's Great Lakes region, where she's been since 2008.
Our mission is human health and the environment, but my job specifically is I work in water enforcement. I'm a stormwater expert, and I regulate the Clean Water Act.
As part of her role at the EPA, Felicia has gone to Flint, Michigan five times to test the drinking water for lead. She spoke to us on behalf of Local Union 704 and as a private citizen. And here's Ethan Shankman, who's held a range of legal jobs in government, including at the EPA.
I was a line attorney at the Department of Justice in the Environment and Natural Resources Division, where my client was the EPA. During the Obama administration, I served as a political appointee at both DOJ and then for the last 3 years of the Obama administration as a deputy general counsel at EPA.
I began our conversation with Felicia Chase, who says the uncertainty of the political climate is the hardest part.
Right now, we're just in a state of not knowing. I wouldn't necessarily say that the morale is down, but we just don't know what the future holds and whether or not, you know, we'll be employed, what programs will be salvaged, which programs will be eliminated. So we actually have our EAB health board has had a lot of posters around our lunch kitchenettes and bathrooms that ask the question, are you stressed? There must be some, you know, some folks that have some concerns.
Well, Ethan Shankman, you're a former counsel there at the EPA, maybe the view from the top or at least from the legal office. How quickly can the ship be turned at the EPA? How many of these regulations can go away overnight?
Well, typically you can't do it overnight. Change is a lot harder than it may look from the outside. And change that is lasting, that will stand up in court, that will be durable and stand the test of time, is even more challenging. The general legal principle is that whatever process you needed to follow to enact a regulation in the first place is the same process that you need to follow to modify or rescind or replace that regulation. So, you know, for example, a number of the regulations that EPA promulgated under the Clean Air Act to address greenhouse gas emissions went through a fairly robust notice and comment rulemaking process. And although the agency has signaled that it is reviewing those regulations and may or may not reconsider them, to do so, it would have to go through another fairly robust notice and comment rulemaking process. And it requires the agency to build a record that provides a reasoned explanation for the change and factual and scientific support for whatever they replace it with.
Well, let's talk about some of that factual and scientific support with you, Joe Arvai, because you're on the Scientific Advisory Board. What's been the reaction among your fellow board members or even scientists more broadly, and what does it mean?
Well, I think from scientists broadly, there's been some backlash and anger. I think that's putting it mildly within the ranks of the independent science advisors that are working with the EPA at the moment. I think there's a variety of feelings, from anger to bewilderment to just frustration with a lot of their worst fears coming true. I think that every day that passes, that more stringent regulations aren't imposed around clean air or on clean water in certain places is going to lead to declines that we're not going to be able to come back from. And then if we look at it from an individual perspective, I think that there are going to be people who suffer declines in their own health that they're not going to be able to recover from. So I think a lot of my colleagues and certainly myself see our responsibility as quite important. We take it seriously, and we take it seriously because the EPA is fundamentally there to protect the environment from people and to protect people from the environment.
There are more than 15,000 full-time EPA employees. More than half of them are engineers, scientists, environmental protection specialists, and they're spread across 11 divisions in 10 regions and 27 laboratories. They regulate our air, water, land, hazardous waste, and even some endangered species using fines and sanctions to enforce the rules. In total, that makes for a budget of around $8 billion, and that's actually pretty small compared to many other Washington agencies. But as we've heard, that doesn't stop the EPA from being a target. There's a proposed 31% budget cut for fiscal year 2018 that, if it were enacted by Congress, would hit regional offices especially hard. That has Felicia Chase worried about her work on clean water in states like Illinois and Michigan.
What I would say about the proposed budget cuts that we've seen and the way that our management and leadership is dealing with that is, you know, we're going to have to shift and move things around. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative comes to mind because I know that that was almost completely in the proposed budget, completely eliminated the funding for that program, which is just alarming from the standpoint of, I mean, this is the largest freshwater, you know, body source in the world. So I guess I'd have to echo that there are frustrations, and we are just in a state of thinking about how do we do more or the same with less. It will ultimately, I think, affect the way that we're able to do our jobs in terms of just ingenuity, in terms of, you know, sustainability. I know that climate change is on the minds of a lot of folks, and that's in fact real science, and how that's going to affect, you know, the future. But we have been getting an overwhelming postcards coming into our agency, to different inspectors and different folks that work there, staff, just thanking us for the work that we do, recognizing, you know, in recognition of the work that we do. So it's kind of been the first time in the history, I've been there for 10 years, but that we've had this kind of support from the public.
Ethan Shankman, from your view as a lawyer listening to Felicia Chase and Joe Arvai talk about some of the frustration and anxiety, does a change in scientific orientation in the advisory boards signal a difference in the way policy is going to get made at this EPA? Does it signal that they're going to do things really differently, or that they just want to have hands cupped over ears, or does it not mean that?
Felicia and Joe make some good points, but I think, to be fair, I think it's too early to tell really what's going to happen. We're still fairly early in this administration. The EPA has announced that it will review any number of regulations, but we don't know yet what will come out of that review. And that's not uncommon for when a new administration takes office. When the Obama administration took office, and before that, when the Bush administration took office, and before that, when the Clinton administration took office, there would typically be a period of time when they would take the regulatory initiatives of previous administrations under review and decide whether to change course, either in an incremental way or in a drastic way. We just don't know. from the perspective of the incoming administration, from the new administration, to the extent they have an ambitious agenda of regulatory reform and change, that, as I said before, does take a lot of work and it takes a lot of resources, they may find that it's a little bit self-defeating. Whatever they do that's new, that's a change, that's a modification, or just a rescission of a previous regulation, it will be tested in court. The courts will take a hard look, and there will need to be a sufficiently strong record to support whatever it is the agency decides to do, so that if they don't do their homework and they take shortcuts, they may wind up just being held up in the courts and potentially have their new decisions set aside at the end of the day.
Budgets are important. You've talked about why science and data are important. Let's be honest, this is a big agency that makes news. Popular opinion is important too, and popular opinion on the EPA's mission has shifted.
Yeah, I must say that the timing of this change is puzzling, to say the least. As you pointed out, I think a recent study out of Yale is showing now that a near majority of Trump voters, people who voted for Trump in the last election, believe that climate change is real and think that climate action is necessary. If you look at the 50 states in the union, a majority of people in each of those states believes that climate change is real and action should be taken. So it seems like a very strange time to be pulling back the reins on science and the EPA's mission. As Ethan pointed out, administrations change. I had the privilege of working for the EPA under the Bush administration, now under the Trump administration, and between those two, the Obama administration. And what I would say is that what I seem to be seeing now is a real sort of disrespect for the agency, for what the agency's mission is for safeguarding the health of the environment and the health of the people who supported this current president who appointed Scott Pruitt. And from within the agency, I see a fundamental misunderstanding of what these science advisory boards actually do. I think that if more industry scientists are appointed to these boards, but they're credible industry scientists like the ones I work with now on the board from Dow or from other companies, then I don't think much will change in terms of the quality of the science advice. On the other hand, if the replacements on the boards are from people who question mainstream science or are merely shills for industry, then I think we run into very dangerous territory.
Well, Joe, what are your colleagues saying about the near or maybe intermediate future of those science advisory boards? Do you have friends and colleagues who are crouched to speak out?
I would hope so. I mean, I you kind of pointed this out at the outset. This isn't a typical position for scientists to be in. Most scientists prefer to do their work and mind their own business. They hope that their work makes an impact, but they're not out there to make noise in the public. If I were to get a call after ending this interview with you today saying that people didn't take very favorably to my comments and my role at the EPA was being terminated, frankly, I would wear that as a badge of honor. I'm not going away. I won't be quiet. And I have a feeling that a lot of my colleagues are feeling the same way about now.
Joe Arvai is director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan and a member of the EPA Science Advisory Board. Felicia Chase is an EPA Region 5 Water Enforcement Officer in the Great Lakes, representing the AFGE local union there. And Ethan Shankman is former Deputy General Counsel at the EPA and now a partner at Arnold and Porter K. Scholer's Environmental Group. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Let's go back now to Columbia Falls in the northwest corner of Montana. We were there earlier in the hour when we visited a new Superfund site. It's just a 20-minute drive from Glacier National Park, a million acres of pristine environment where a global problem is hitting home. It hit home before we even got to the park. As we were driving on US 2 en route to the park, a push notification came from the New York Times. It said, Antarctica's ice sheet may be approaching an unstoppable collapse. And when you arrive in Glacier, you find out that that collapse is already well underway. Of the estimated 150 glaciers in the park, just 25 are left.
I am watching the subjects of my research disappear.
That's Dan Fagree. He studies glaciers in the park for the U.S. Geological Survey. His office is in a small cabin in park headquarters, and it's lined with photographs showing the changes.
This is a photo of Shepherd Glacier in the northern part of the park in 1913, and this is only 3 years after Glacier National Park was founded. And you see a real robust glacier there that comes down out of the mountain and has an arm that goes down onto a big ledge. And then you flash forward to 2005, and you see essentially the glacier is gone.
The glaciers that do remain are expected to be all gone by 2030, and Fagri says the melting is irreversible. Even in the middle of May in 2017, you could see that on some glaciers, there just isn't a lot of ice left.
Well, with regard to the glaciers, there's not anything we can do. They are just responding to climate change, and it's already too warm to sustain them. They're just taking a long time to melt. So these glaciers wouldn't be saved unless we had a big cooling event occur here, and that's not very likely given the trends we see in the global climate.
And that has major implications, all the way down to the thousands of different insect species that call this place home.
The two species that we're working on are Lednia tumana, which is known as meltwater stonefly, and Zapata glacier, the western glacier stonefly. And both of these species have been petitioned for protection under the Endangered Species Act due to the effects of climate change.
And that is
Joe Gersh, and I work as an aquatic entomologist for the U.S. Geological Survey, and I work on aquatic insects in glacial and alpine streams in Glacier National Park. These insects are, their biology is very closely associated with temperatures. And so if the streams get too warm, then they just can't survive in those streams anymore.
I asked Joe Gersh if those flies are what's known as an indicator species.
Bingo. Yep, that's it.
Meaning the changes in those species signal a larger shift in the ecosystem.
We're not just talking about two species of stoneflies. We're talking about an entire community of animals living in these streams. They're animals that we know very little about. And then ultimately, you know, they're fed by glaciers and permanent snowfields that really we all rely on.
As the fight over climate change and environmental regulations rages in Washington, Gersh and Fagri carry on their work trying to generate the science that shows how things are changing now before they're permanently gone.
Our work has global implications. You know, we're talking about global climate change, but we're talking about habitats which occur throughout the world.
Joe Gersh's stoneflies are a mostly hidden sign of a warming planet. The fading glaciers in the park are a clear one. These scientists are warning that they're signs that the world is being irreversibly altered. Still, the ecosystem is complex and diverse, and the changes you can see don't mean there isn't still enduring normalcy.
This is the spring runoff. It's very normal. Sometimes it's higher than this if we have a hot spell or additional rain input, but you can see that there's still quite a bit of snowpack here in the middle of May. And in fact, a lot of the trails here don't open until July because they're still covered in snow. So that big snowpack is what you're seeing bleeding out on this river here.
The Montanans who live along that river and near it, they know the glaciers are disappearing. They know the environment is changing, but here, for many, giving up a way of life or the jobs that sustain it, it's not an option.
My great-grandparents homesteaded in the Flathead, and my great-grandparents and family were loggers.
That's Republican State Senator Dee Brown, who we spoke with earlier in the hour about that Columbia Falls Superfund site. We met up just outside the national park at the Glacier Diner.
I remember in 1967, my grandfather, there was a forest fire across from Big Creek. And everybody, all the loggers got together and everybody got together. And my grandfather took his D4 cat across the river and helped put out that fire. Now, that would never happen today. I mean, they'd have to call the feds, and they'd have to call the, you know, it just wouldn't happen that way. And now we're in really dire fire situations that are catastrophic. I mean, look at the trees right across here. Half of them are dead. You know, one little spark this summer is going to create havoc.
Glacier National Park is a billboard for tourism in Montana. Non-residents spent nearly $3.5 billion in the state last year. But as temperatures fluctuate and wildfire season becomes longer and burns hotter, that economic cycle of tourism gets harder to bank on.
Sad thing about this area is that it's so seasonal. We have people who work in the park. Then they're unemployed, then they work on Big Mountain, then they're unemployed. So we need the kind of jobs that are sustainable, that can raise a family.
Montana calls itself the Treasure State, and it's not because of the tourists who flock to Dee Brown's neighborhood. It's because of its vast natural resources. Now, that used to mean gold. Today, it's because the state has an estimated 25% of the nation's recoverable coal reserves.
Coal, as far as the state of Montana's economy and the world economy goes, I have always been a supporter of Montana coal. Number one, because it's a cheap fuel, and number two, because it burns better and cleaner than any that you get out of Indonesia. So if we really cared about our environment, we would push Montana coal into the overseas markets because it's a cleaner product and it makes for great paying jobs here and not in the dirty coal of Indonesia.
So then there's the key question for Dee Brown. You know the glaciers are disappearing. You know the wildfires are worse. You also know that fossil fuel is important to the economy. Is the need for coal connected to climate change?
I think it's a natural process. I think the climate is always changing. And I think that scientists have duly noted it, but there are scientists on the other side that said, look, we've always changed, we're always going to change, we're always going to morph into something different, and we can see that in our forests.
Change is change, Dee Brown says, and there's just not much we can do about it.
I mean, that's why we're driving cars instead of riding horses. Things change.
Up in the park, Dan Fagry, the glacier scientist, he seemed to expect that answer.
Well, I think that a lot of people simply need to see the evidence. And this is, I think, what our job is to provide that. We can't change how people view the evidence, but we can provide the best data quality that's possible. And I think that the images that we produce here and the continued monitoring of the glaciers are part of that picture that we have to portray. And how it's received is up to other people.
Soon after Takeaway producer Mara Silvers and I left Glacier National Park, it was time to fly home. On my way to the airport, I thought about Joe Gersh's stoneflies and about Dee Brown. I thought about Montana and its let us alone spirit. But I had to stop the car because a big freight train was rolling by. It was loaded with coal and all of the things that coal means for Montana. That train carried the jobs and the traditions and the carbon. Thanks so much for listening to today's full hour on the EPA. To listen back, head to thetakeaway.org and you can subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tech products, solutions, and services for business like PC setup and repair, data recovery, and virus protection. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, it's pro time. TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.